Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this August the 12th on the West Coast, now August the 13th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Also, I'd like to welcome all the folks that are listening around the world on BlogTalkRadio.com and especially Wind Talkers Radio Network. We appreciate you carrying the show, whether it's live or later on in the daytime or the nighttime on an archive. We're about getting the truth out there, and we appreciate the fact that you folks are interested in hearing the truth, especially those in the U.S. military on bases around the world. We appreciate the work you're doing, and we are grateful that you're tuning in tonight. We're going to bring a lot of truth forward on tonight's show, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time building up this individual. Actually, I had Ken Adachi on the schedule until sometime later in the day, early evening, and we were able to get a very, very experienced replacement for Ken, and Ken recommended this individual. He's been on Evident Footprints in the past, early in my show's 2-year career, and he is a wealth of information. You are going to see that immediately. His reputation precedes him. He is the former supervisory special agent for the Los Angeles District of the FBI, and his name is Ted Gunderson. Ted, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Thank you very much, Don, and it's a pleasure to be on your show. I'd substitute for old Ken any day.
Well, as I told you off the air, it's been my intention to have you on the show, and I know you've been a busy man. I've heard you on a lot of different broadcasts over the past couple of months. Despite all the work you're doing, I really want to thank you personally for coming on such short notice. And also, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing on behalf of many missing children, many abused children, many abused women, people that are suffering throughout their whole lives. You have taken a stand that is quite admirable, and on behalf of everyone that cannot say thank you to you, I extend that that gratitude.
Thank you, Don. I just do what I have to do. That's all. I was in charge of the FBI Los Angeles Division. My official title was Senior Special Agent in Charge. I had over 700 personnel under my command and a $22.5 million budget. And I retired March 30, 1979. So I've been out like 30 years. And it's kind of interesting because I opened my own private investigation firm. Well, first of all, I went to San Juan, Puerto Rico for the Pan Am Games. I coordinated security there right after I retired, August 1979. And then I came back and opened my own firm. My first major investigation was the Dr. Jeffrey R. McDonald triple murders, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, February 17, 1970. And I entered the case. And when I was in the FBI for 27 plus years, I really had phenomenal success in interviewing suspects. And to be honest with you, I never interviewed a suspect when they didn't give me a confession. I was just your good old neighborhood FBI guy. I was, treated people the way I wanted to be treated if the situation was reversed. And so I went into the McDonald case thinking, well, this is going to be a tough one because he'd already been tried and convicted and sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences. And, when I first went into it, I started reading the material on the case. First, anytime you get involved in a case, you have to read everything. You make notes, and it's very tedious work.
Yeah, yes.
And it's like any other job. Details win, okay, like a coach in football. A coach that's good at details usually wins. And so I read everything I could get my hands on, the testimony, and, there's volumes and volumes and volumes of information there. And I said to myself, there's something that's not right about this case. I suspect there's drugs involved. And sure enough, I eventually, through my investigation and by interviewing various individuals, I eventually developed extensive information about the large-scale drug operation where the covert government, Army, and probably the CIA, I can't say for sure CIA, never had specific information about that,
yeah,
bringing drugs in plastic bags in the body cavities of dead GIs, flying them into air bases all over the United States. And this, later on I learned, Time Magazine, January 1, 1973, this was true. They documented it for me, but I had it documented also, and in 1980. And then I said, you know, this may be a tough one. I may lose my record of never getting a statement from a suspect. And sure enough, you know, I got into the case and I interviewed Helena Stokely, who had made admissions, not confessions, but admissions to like five or six people. And so I concentrated on going after Helena. And the first thing I did is I hooked up with Prince Beasley, retired police officer, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Fantastic guy. Unfortunately, he's passed on. And Prince had used this girl, Helena Stokely, as an informant, a drug informant, for years when he was on the Fayetteville Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And so Prince introduced me to her, but it wasn't that easy. What happened is I knew I had to go after her, and I knew I had to get her to talk. I knew that would break the case. As any good investigator knows, your instincts tell you which direction to go. Instincts, experience, and training, of course.
Yes.
And what happened was she was not available, but Prince knew her brother, Clarence. And so one night we appeared late in the evening, not late, but late in the afternoon, early evening. It was dark, I remember, at Clarence's house, unexpected, and knocked on the door, went in, Prince and I did, and Clarence's wife was there, but Clarence was not there. He had not come home yet. As I recall, he was a shoe salesman in one of the stores, retail stores there. And so we sat down, told her who we were. We wanted to talk to Clarence, Alina's brother. And sure enough, he finally came in to the house, and he was drunk, and he was highly suspicious of Prince and me. And as a matter of fact, the family did not like Prince at all. They didn't like Fayetteville Police because they knew that Helena, they'd used Helena to the extent of her being an informant for them. And later on, Prince told me that she was the most successful informant, was responsible for more than 100 arrests involving drugs. Well, actually what that was, arrests of individuals outside Fayetteville, so they eliminate the competition, of course.
Yeah.
And so Clarence came in, and his wife, he sat down and looked at me, looked at Prince, and so I started talking to him and said, you know, we'd like to talk to your sister. And he was not real cooperative, but I never forget it. He was, his wife brought him a meal. We were in the living room. He put it on his lap, and he was, as I say, he was drunk, and he spilled half the food on the carpet. It kind of slid off his plate, and I ignored that. And so, long story short, after probably talking to him for probably 45, 50 minutes, we convinced Clarence to let me talk to Helena. But he said that she won't talk to you in person. Go to a certain telephone, and there was a school there within a block and a half or two of Clarence's house, and wait by that payphone. And so Prince and I went there, and the phone, after a while, took about a half an hour. After a while, the phone rang, and it was Helena, and she talked to Prince. I said, Prince, talk to her, and introduce me. And she talked to Prince for a little while, and then she introduced her to me, turned the phone over to me, and I told her, I said, Helena, I'm retired FBI chief. I'm back here investigating the McDonald murders. I said, you know, I want to get your side of the story. I said, and I indicated to her that I had an informant on the inside already, although I didn't, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I said, you know, I have information already about this case, and I have a lot of information. I have some people that are furnishing me information, and I said, I'd like to get your side. And she said, well, no, I'm not going to cooperate with you. And finally, Ernie Davis, her husband, got on the phone and told me to drop dead and to get out of her life, and hung up on me. Well, I planted that seed, okay?
Yes.
And then later on, I forget exactly how many years later or how many months later, I developed 19 new witnesses. I was there the whole month of January 1980. I developed like 19 new witnesses without going into a lot of detail. It'd probably take me 3 or 4 hours to go into each one of them. And then I ended up going back to Los Angeles. And then pretty soon, that was the first session. I was there, as I said, a month. And then Prince calls me. I think it was in May of 1980. And he said that, it was in October of 1980.
Ted, I hate to interrupt you. We're hearing some talking in the background, which is kind of carrying over the airwaves. I'm wondering if you can crack the whip.
Okay, hang on just a minute. Hey,
okay.
John, they're here on the radio here, on the air. Let me go in the kitchen.
Okay, thank you, Ted.
While
Ted is going into the kitchen, the chat room is alive and buzzing here on the show. I'm glad there are folks. I hope you're paying attention to this, because this is critical evidence that's been kept out of the trial of Jeffrey McDonald. This man has been serving a prison sentence for a crime he did not commit for over 30 years now.
Yes,
and
definitely.
This is a travesty of injustice, we'll call it.
Absolutely. So, anyway, so then I get a call from, in October of 1980, I get a call from Prince, and Helena and her husband gotten in a fight, and he beat her up, and he was arrested and put in jail, $200 bail, and Prince called me and said, what do? I said, make the bail if he will come back and talk to us, come to California, and I was going to pay his way, and I sent Prince $200, and he jumped on a plane with Ernie and brought him back, and he gave us a signed statement about everything that Helena had told him about the McDonald murders, and said the effect that she had said when the trial came up, she was watching it, and she said, I'm in trouble now, and so on and so forth, and I was involved, but didn't go into a lot of detail. So then on the way to the airport to take him home, he had to go back for a hearing because he'd beaten up Helena. And I was driving, and he and Prince were in the back seat. And I forget why they were in back. I was trying to pretend like I was a chauffeur, I guess, trying to be somebody important. But I said to Prince, that new informant we developed has, and then I stopped, like we had somebody, and I shouldn't have said that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked in the rearview mirror, and I winked at Prince, who was watching me. He wasn't watching the rearview mirror. And he gets off the plane. I understand. We found out later. Prince stayed there. He gets off the plane in Fayetteville. And Helena, in the meantime, they'd made up on the telephone. And Helena says to Helena, when he catches up with her, Prince learned this later, hey, we've got to get out of town. Gunderson has developed an informant inside the group. We got to leave. And so they left and went down to South Carolina. And he jumped bail, of course. So I lost my $200. But it was well worth it, because Prince located Ernie Davis and Helena in South Carolina. And he said, what should I do? I said, well, go to law enforcement, have them go down and pick him up. They pick up Ernie. And so he went to law enforcement. They did nothing. And I guess about 2 or 3 weeks later, he called again. He said, I can't get anybody to go get her. I said, well, Prince, we made bail for him, so we have the authority to go to South Carolina ourselves and arrest him and bring him back like a bail bondsman does with a bounty hunter. So Prince went down, and with the assistant chief of police, and I think it was Walhalla, South Carolina. It was outside of there. It wasn't Walhalla. Walhalla, I think, is a pretty good-sized town. A little small town outside, right across the North Carolina border. Prince, with the assistant chief of police, goes in, arrests Ernie, and then they're putting him in the car. And Helena says, well, I'll hitchhike back. And like I say, they'd made up by then. And so Prince says, no, you get in the car, I'll drive you back. It was about a five-hour drive from Fayetteville. So they got in the car. And then Prince and some Prince, but Helena and Ernie started arguing. And he was saying, don't go back there. And she says, yeah, I think maybe I should go back there. And they're going back and forth. And but they got in a heated argument. Prince didn't say anything, let it go. And then when they got to Fayetteville, he let them both out of the car. And Ernie knocked Helena down and stomped on her. And so they had to physically take, of course he was in handcuffs, that didn't matter. They had to physically take control of Ernie, put him in. And as they were walking in the building, he hit her again. And then Helena, after they placed him in jail, Helena says to Prince, let's go see Gunderson. And, so it worked. So, Prince put her on an airplane and Prince and Helena flew back to Los Angeles. And, I ended up, after, about 3 or 4 days getting acquainted and talking and making her feel comfortable, she finally gave me a signed statement. And in the statement, she said that she was in a satanic cult, that the cult was involved in distributing drugs up and down the East Coast, that, long story short, of course, there were generals involved in the drug operation. There were enlisted personnel. There were police officers. There were two attorneys in Fayetteville. And I knew, right, as I said earlier on the show, I knew there was drugs involved. I just had a feeling for it. And so she ended up giving me a detailed description on tape, I had it on tape, of all the events that took place inside the house that night. She said that they had celebrated earlier. One of the cult leaders, a guy named Wizard, who I later identified, and the cult members did not know Wizard's true identity. He was from California. That a guy named Wizard said, we're going to go get McDonald. He's been abusive to our brothers and sisters who go to Womack, Cape to the civilian hospital, and I forget the name of it. Cape might have been Cape Fear, but and when the GIs would go to the civilian hospital rather than the military hospital, they would go there because at the military hospital they were being given dishonorable discharge. Well, somebody at the civilian hospital was also turning them in, and they were being given dishonorable discharges. And Jeff McDonald was very abusive to them. He didn't tolerate the drug scene. And when they would come in high on drugs, he'd make them sit in a corner and suffer before you treat them and so forth. So they were mad at Dr. McDonald. And what she did, she told us, that was the motive. And she said that if she was given immunity, she would drop a bomb on the case, meaning about the drug operation, people involved in it, and so on and so forth. And later on, after she left, and I'm going to come back to the crime scene in just a minute.
Okay.
But after she left, I think it was a couple of days later, we put her back on a plane and let her go back to North Carolina. After she left, I forget where I thought was going. I got off the track there. We learned, of course, about the large-scale drug operation and confirmed it and what have you. But during the confession, she told us that the two people over Jeff. Jeff was on a couch, and they came in, broke into the house through the back door by the kitchen. And Dwight Smith, this is all in the statement. This is public record, so you don't have to worry about being sued. And Dwight Smith and Dwight Smith and Shelby Don Harris. And Helena stood over Dr. McDonald, and Helena is chanting, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, acid is groovy, kill the pigs. Of course, they were all high on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Smith had a club, and Shelby Don Smith, Harris had a knife, and there was, I forget who the third person, right off the top of my head. There were two and Helena standing over him. And Jeff had taken his pajama tops and put them around his wrist to feint off the blows. He felt a sharp pain to his left side and lost consciousness. And when he woke up, like probably an hour, hour and a half later, he was half in the hall and half in the living room. And he had been there on the couch in the family room or the living room. because when he went to bed that night, the child, the 5.5-year-old child, had wet the bed, so he went back down and slept in the living room rather than stay in the wet bed and let the child. I don't know what he did with the child. I think she was in the same master bedroom, and her body was found there. And he woke up there was total silence probably an hour and a half after he was stabbed, and he went back and Colette, his wife, who was pregnant by the third child, was slaughtered. I think she had like 28 stab wounds in her, and he put his pajama tops over top of her, as any logical doctor would do to keep her warm. Unconsciously did that, even though she was passed on.
Yeah, he was pretty in bad shape himself. I understand he was stabbed about 17 times, is that correct?
Exactly. 17 times is right. But you know the case, then. That's good.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it from having read about it and studied and interviewing Ken Adachi. Ken is very knowledgeable. Plus, we interviewed Catherine also.
Right, yes. Well, am I repeating something that I shouldn't be repeating?
No. This is very pertinent to the listening audience because you're bringing out some details, some intimate details. If we can pause just for a second.
Sure.
This attack on Jeffrey McDonald, as I understand it, came about as a result of an order that came down through the base commander or the CID in regard to reporting of drug users in the military. The doctors were instructed to report this. Now, to my knowledge, he hadn't made any complaints or any reports, but this was sort of like a warning to the doctors, possibly, or that he was targeted as if he was so clean-cut, all-American type, that he would be one who would report this, because there were obviously people in the military using drugs.
That's right.
So that's the general premise behind the attack, at least as I understand it. Do you have any other information in that regard?
No, that was basically the motive. And again, as I said, he was very abusive. When they went in for treatment, he would not have any sympathy for them, and so his stab wound. It was an ice pick, almost it was within just fraction of an inch of his liver, as I recall, which he would have probably bled to death had it hit his liver.
Yeah.
While he was fighting with Harris and Shelby Don Harris and Eddie and Dwight Smith, and Alina was chanting after his groovy ass groovy, Colette yelled, Jeff, why are they doing this to me? And the little 5.5-year-old yelled, Daddy, Daddy, help me, help me. And, a tragic, tragic situation. And then, of course, Selena gave me all the details, told me that Greg Mitchell was back there with Colette. And then later on, Dr. Noguchi, who looked at all the evidence and the pictures, said that Colette was attacked by a left-handed person. And Greg Mitchell was left-handed, as a matter of fact. Helena said that a man named Wizard, whose true name was not known to them, and I later learned what it was the person who was in charge of that particular cult. So that's basically, that was the inside story. Then they left, and by the way, on the way in, one of the neighbors heard a dog bark. And excuse me, on the way out, I think it was. The neighbor, they didn't hear it going in, but on the way out. They were in the house probably 2.5, what did they say? Did Kathy say how long they were in the house? An hour and a half, 2 hours?
I'm not exactly sure, but an hour and a half sounds about right. I mean, that seems to, be what Ken and she said.
Yeah, an hour and a half. And while they were there, the phone rang. And Alina picked up the phone, and a male voice on the other end said, ask for Dr. McDonald. And Dwight Smith yelled to Alina, this is what Alina put in her statement, hang up the GD phone, and she hung up the phone. Now, when the MPs arrived later, somebody wiped the phone, so there were no prints there. And also, there were, I don't know how many prints that were unidentified, and they threw them away, And when I think in the Article 32 military hearing, which preceded the grand jury and the trial itself, the fingerprint expert said they threw them away because they didn't know who they belonged to. I mean, that's horrible. that's absolutely unbelievable that anybody would do that. I forget how many there were. There were quite a few that were unidentified. There was all kind of evidence at the scene. And then the latest information on the case is in 1997, the judge Fox, who replaced Dupree, Judge Dupree, who passed on, and Fox and Dupree were very close friends. Judge Fox authorized DNA tests. They completed the tests, I think, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and they withheld presenting them. They didn't withhold sending them to the court. They presented them to the court, and the judge just within the last 4 or 5 months came out with this and basically ignored them. And the DNA test proved that there was somebody else in the house. For example, I think the little 5 and a half had a hair under her fingernail with the root on it. It didn't belong to anybody in the family. So that, you know, that's real good evidence to prove that somebody else was in there besides the family. And, of course, it was a mess. It was a huge, huge cover-up. Colette also had skin under her nails, under her fingernails, and that skin was scraped. I've been at scenes where there was a cadaver, by the way, and you scrape the fingernails always.
Yes.
In an envelope. And that envelope was given to William Ivory, the chief investigator. I think it was his first major investigation as an Army CID, Criminal Investigation Division investigator. And the envelope was lost. And he was challenged on it. He says, well, I turned it over to the laboratory. And the laboratory said, no, we never received it. So that one smelled real bad. And, of course, from the skin, they could have determined if it was somebody in the family or somebody from the outside. But that's basically how I broke the case with the help of Prince Beasley and by letting Helena think that we had an insider. And that was kind of interesting because I did have some pictures of her group from one of my witnesses, and I put them in a report. I prepared around an 11 or 1,200-page report, and I put this picture in the report, and I took the picture and showed it to Lena when I was interviewing her. And I'm saying, Alina, can you identify these people? And she flipped the pages front and back a couple of pages. I said, Alina, the information, the person that gave me that picture is not identified. And the picture was identified as a confidential source, by the way, in the report. And so she did think, as a matter of fact, we had an insider. And I let her think we had an insider. And she would do very well to tell me what happened because to protect herself. And and she went for it. And she went for it, took line and sinker. And that's pretty much, I'm trying to think of what other detail I might throw in here. I guess that's about what happened in the house. Alina told me movement around, as I said, the people involved. And so I have all this documentation. I have this statement. And years later, we presented it to the court. It was actually before Judge Dupree died. And I'm on the witness stand about 2.5 or 3 hours. Murtaugh, the prosecutor, tried to discredit me. He even tried to bring out information about my sex life. I was waiting for O'Neill, the attorney for Dr. McDonald, to object. And I looked at him. He didn't object. And so I was able to skirt that because it's none of his business. And I held my own when I testified, that was it. And then the courts rejected all my statements. I had 3 sessions with Helena, not only the first session, but two later. And in every instance, I took audio taped interviews with her and gave them to Brian O'Neill, the attorney, who was a former U.S. attorney, by the way. And I wrote the letter. When Lena told me that she would drop a bomb on the case, I wrote, if she was given immunity, I wrote a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice. And I told them that this girl is willing to talk and give us further detail. And Brian O'Neill, the attorney, he had just come aboard. He had replaced Bernie Siegel. And he wrote a letter to the Department of Justice, said, I'm in charge of the case, disregard Ted's request to give Helena immunity. So I was kind of suspicious of that. I still have a copy of the letter. And we'll see what happens. By the way, I had all the witnesses I interviewed, being a retired FBI chief and having a lot of confidence in the FBI at that time, as I said a few moments ago, I submitted an 1,200-page report to the personally to Judge William Webster, who was the director of the FBI, thinking that the FBI would take my report and build on it because in the cover letter I said, this man's innocent and somebody needs to get him out. Well, mm-hmm. instead of looking at my report and building on the case, agents came out. The FBI did not enter the case until after I entered the case, by the way. The agents came out and talked to my 19 witnesses and tried to get them to recant, every one of them. So I was really shocked. I was set back on that one. And so we had, and then later on, a guy named Madden, an FBI agent named Madden, I think his name was Butch Madden, but I'm not sure of his first name, excuse me. He wanted to interview me, and I said, yeah, I'll talk to anybody. That's the way I am, to be honest with you. And if I'm right, I'll talk to anybody. And I always try to be right. And Bernard Siegel, the attorney, said that he would not allow me to be interviewed unless we had the questions in advance and on that sort of thing. And I don't know how I ended up going back to North Carolina. But anyway, I agreed to be interviewed by him. And I spent, my interview with him was a couple hours also. And he again tried to discredit me. And I just couldn't believe it. Here I am, an FBI chief, and I developed this new information about a man who's obviously innocent and an obvious cover-up and a large-scale drug operation, and everybody's ignoring me. In fact, they're trying to do everything they can to discredit mm-hmm. me. Now, I mentioned a few moments ago that the FBI entered the case after I entered the case. Well, what happened? Initially, there was a turf war between the FBI and the Army. And Bill Murphy, Bob Murphy, who was the agent in charge of Charlotte, and I knew Bob personally, by the way, and he was a great guy. I traveled with him when I was in the FBI as an inspector. And Bob Murphy said, we don't want to get into the case because the crime scene has been botched. And a fellow named Henry Schultz in headquarters, in charge of crime on a government reservation, said, yes, we want to get into it. So Bob ended up winning that little turf war. And we did not get in it, and the crime scene was absolutely unbelievably botched, badly. And
in what way would you describe that?
Well, the telephone was wiped. The coffee table was tipped over, and it went apparently, as I recall, it went all the way over on upside down. And they said that Jeff had staged the crime scene. But you see, what they didn't take into consideration when the coffee table was tipped, which was where Jeff would have fought them off, somebody could have been standing there and caused it to go all the way over instead of part way over. And then there were some Valentine cards there, as I recall, and there was a question about them. And then also, now more important than that, the house was not protected. And then there were, like, I don't know how many people, 15, 20 people in suits who came prancing through there in the crime scene. It was not protected at all. And there was a vase that had been turned over. I also recall that. And so it was botched badly. And then, of course, I mentioned about the fingerprints that they found, and they said that they threw them away because they were unidentified to anybody in the family. And an obvious cover-up. But anyway, the Army, anyway, ended up winning, taking over the case and investigating it. And then the Army, and the only part that the FBI had in the case initially was they sent the evidence to the FBI laboratory. And so the FBI laboratory were the only ones involved in it. But when I entered the case and started developing new witnesses, and as I said, I developed like 19 new witnesses, and submitted a 1,200 page report and all that sort of thing, thinking in all honesty the FBI would be in a great organization that I had just left within, you know, a short period of time before this, would say, hey, this man is innocent. We need to, you know, to further work and establish that he is innocent based on what Gunderson did. Well, they didn't. They came in and, as I said, they interviewed my witnesses, tried to get them to recant. So the FBI did not enter the case until I started taking these statements.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ted, if I can interject a couple of questions here.
Sure.
With preface with the statement that this occurred on base housing.
Right.
This was on Fort Bragg, right?
Right. Open base.
Okay. Did they depose or question any of the security guards at the base entrance? How is it that this group gained access to the base?
It was an open base. It was an open base. People could just drive on.
It was an open base. Okay.
Yeah, there were no gates, no guards, no anything. It was an open base. And, of course, the address is 544 Castle Drive. And, by the way, they just tore down that the apartment house. It was a duplex, as I recall. And one of my contacts back there sent me a big brick that came out of the house as a souvenir of the case. And this particular contact, a former Green Beret, who had been a friend of mine for years and has helped in some of my work. Did you have any more questions?
Well, you know, now I'm on the basis of how you responded to my first question regarding how they got on the base, and you know, if they were seen coming on the base, if no one thought that was unusual, that obviously they weren't dressed like they're in the military, I'm presuming.
No.
And I guess that would pertain to Helena Stokely's affidavit to you and her admission of guilt and all of that. It seems to me, under those conditions, that they would know that if there were foreign fingerprints that didn't belong to the family, that they should retain those. That's an obvious cover-up, and they're protecting the drug dimension of this whole thing.
Absolutely.
That's what it's about.
Well, absolutely. Now, they were seen, by the way. I developed a witness in the neighborhood. What they did is they had a meeting at Talina's house before they went to Jeff's house, Dr. McDonald's house. And then they had a little ceremony, and they all were going up and down the streets, one of the streets en route, apparently, to the scene, or at least part of their ceremony, on the base with candles and dressed in sheets, and so forth. So they were seen on the base. And I developed information about that and put it in my statement. So they were seen there. But again, we're talking about another cover-up. Now, there was a neighbor about a half a block away who I located her, and she had moved from Fayetteville. I located her on the East Coast at another state. And I don't need to say what her name is, but anyway, I took a statement from her, and she told me that the night of the murders, that she was sleeping on the second floor of her condo. She was married to a serviceman, and she heard motors idling outside her window, and so she looked out, and she saw a car, a blue Plymouth, as I recall, parked under a lamp, a street light. And she actually identified. See, Jeff gave an artist conception of the four people that he fought with. There was a third man there, and I can't think of his name offhand. I can refresh it with my notes. And she gave it. So she looked at the artist conceptions, and she identified Alan Mansrell as sitting in the car on the passenger side of that car when she looked out the window. She also said that there was a military police vehicle out there, and. And it was, as I said, it was a blue Plymouth that belonged to. Oh, the other one's another fellow named was Bruce Fowler. That was the other fellow, I think.
Okay.
And so she, you know, I developed her as a witness, and so the next day, military police came knocking on all the neighbors' doors, see if they heard anything, and she said, "Yes, yeah." I looked out the window and I saw this car idling. And she later identified Mazzarell. Didn't identify him right at that time. She identified him when I showed the artist's conception to her. And She said, yes, here's what I saw, and I saw a military police vehicle and all that sort of thing, and I saw this car idling the motor and all that sort of thing. As I recall, it was about 4:30 or 5, probably around 3:45, 4 or 4:30 along in there. It was late. And the military police officer said, well, okay, we'll come back later and take a statement from you. And because they canvass, the first thing you're going to do in a crime like that is to canvass the neighborhood, talk to everybody you can. Did you see anything, et cetera, et cetera. So they never came back and talked to her. And I learned about her and took a statement from her. And then also, before they went on the base, around 12:15, 12:30, as I recall, a group of them, the same group, and I was able to identify them through artist conception, to a lady at the Dunkin' Donuts shop in Fayetteville. She saw a group of them come in, and she identified them from the artist conception, and Alina Stokely was one of them, and then some of the men, I forget which of the men she identified, but I showed her the artist conception. She said, yeah, they were here, and then they had candles stuffed in their pockets, and she heard one of them say, come on, let's go, let's get it over with, or something to that effect. And that was, it was after that that I developed a witness who saw them walking down the street burning candles. And then, of course, they ended up coming into the Dr. McDonald's back door, the kitchen. So I had all this information. I was sure once I submitted my report that we were going to get this man off and he'd be free. And here he is. How many years later? You know.
Yeah, 30 years. Now, my understanding of the case, Ted, is that the first charges that were brought against him by the Army, he was exonerated from, and then these other charges were filed some 9 years later.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, yeah. And was it Ivy that was in charge of the case?
Yes.
Okay, he made a career out of this one case, I understand.
Right.
It's just amazing all the information that was kept out. Now, I understand during the second trial, Helena Stokely was given immunity, but she was also threatened that she would serve life in prison if she didn't play by the rule book that was put before her. In other words, a lot of this information that you're describing was kept out of the trial.
Oh, yeah, of course. It was always, see, at the time of the trial, she had never given a confession to anybody. I was the first to get a signed confession from her. But she had made admissions to, like, five or six other people. And so they brought her in, not in front of the jury, but without the jury, and they interviewed her in front of Dupree, and Dupree said that she's not a credible witness because she's a druggie and so on and so forth. So he discounted her, and they didn't let her testify in front of the jury. There's no question about the cover up. It's absolutely unbelievable. This man's still in jail today.
Yes. Well, hopefully he will be exonerated through DNA evidence and other evidence that's coming out. Have you been asked to participate in this next phase of this appeal hearing?
No.
You have
the attorneys have never contacted. New attorneys have never contacted. I was in contact with Bernard Siegel, and I was also in contact with Brian O'Neill. And Bernard Siegel took the case up to appeal, and then he turned it over to O'Neill. And then Bernard Siegel, who had been an attorney in Philadelphia with Bernie Eichmann, not Bernard, but with Dennis Eichmann, I think is his name, another attorney. They had a reputation for defending prostitutes and druggies and so on and so forth. And Jeff, Dr. McDonald, picked them to defend him. He did a masterful job. There was only one trial. The first was a hearing, Article 32, military hearing. And Bernie Siegel did a masterful job in the hearing. But to be honest with you, based on everything I could see, he didn't do that good a job in the trial. And so that's, let the facts speak for themselves. I'm a professional investigator, and I have a right to my opinion, and everything I reviewed, it smelled. And then when Brian O'Neill came on, I was highly suspicious of him, to be honest with you, because I had F. Lee Bailey lined up, and F. Lee Bailey said he'd take the case. And But Jeff hired Brian O'Neill ahead of Effley Bailey, and he said that, I said, well, who recommended him? He said, well, there was a convict in the prison that recommended Brian O'Neill. Well, it was as far as I'm concerned, he should have grabbed Effley Bailey. Effley Bailey was ready to go with it. And Effley Bailey, he said, well, Effley Bailey's a drunk. Well, he might be a heavy drinker, but he was not a drunk. And drunk or sober, he's one of the best attorneys I've ever worked with, and I work with attorneys now for 55 years.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. attorneys and attorneys. So Prince and I broke the case because, mainly, be honest with you, because Helena thought we had already had an informant on the inside because of the slip, so-called slip that I made with taking Ernie Davis to the airport and then letting her see the picture when she came in the office. Now, to prove that Helena was in the house that night, she said that a spring was broken on the rocking horse. And the spring was broken on the rocking horse. And only the McDonald family knew that spring was broken. She said she tried to ride it, and she couldn't ride it because of the broken spring. Well, the prosecution claimed that there was a picture taken through the window by the photographer. They claimed that she came up to that conclusion based on the picture that the photographer took through the window. I have a copy of the picture. And it does not, you cannot see that the spring is broken. Also, in talking to Helena, I said, Helena, tell me about the furniture and tell me about the room and draw a diagram of the layout of the house, of the apartment or whatever. It was duplex, I think it was. And so she did that. And what else? And she said, well, I remember the jewelry box in the master bedroom on the table, on the master dresser.
Mm-hmm.
And the dresser, she said I remember that. I said, well, now wait a minute. I said, hold it right there. And I went down to Sears Roebuck and got a copy of their catalog, and I brought it back, and without coaching her at all, I said, Helena, look through this catalog and look at the jewelry boxes there, and tell me which one it most closely resembled. She picked out the very jewelry box that was in the McDonald house. In fact, it was a Sears Roebuck jewelry box. So there was no question about her. I gave her a polygraph. She passed it. Everybody ignored me.
Well, it wouldn't even matter if she knew if there was a broken spring on the rocking horse or not. She knew there was a rocking horse.
That's right. Well, you could see the rocking horse through the picture that was taken through the window, but you couldn't see that the spring was broken.
Uh-huh.
And that was what the prosecution, Murtaugh, claimed. And then also the latest information is the marshal overheard Helena agreeing to give a confession to Jim Blackburn, and he said that if she came forward now, they'd charge her with murder. And so she backed off, of course, and rather than
mm-hmm.
and then seek her cooperation, didn't work out that well. And then in the meantime, I understand Helena's mother, of course, Helena died January 1983, as I recall. And in the meantime, Helena's mother, after her husband died, who was a colonel, retired colonel in the Army, came forward and said that Helena had given her the same basic information that she gave me in my assigned statements. So there's confirmation there, and I'd never talked to the mother before. And then Helena, she died mysteriously and said she died of slight pneumonia of each lung and cirrhosis of the liver, but she died with, she was nude from the waist down, and the kitchen faucet was running, and she had called Prince about a week or so before and told Prince that she was concerned because there were two men in suits that kept appearing in the neighborhood, and she thought she was under surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Prince called me and said, what do I do? I said, Prince, get in the car and go down there immediately. And he called Brian O'Neill, and O'Neill told him not to go down. That's what Prince told me. And the next thing we know, she died. The six-month-old child was still alive on the floor, apparently. And it was in a crib or on the floor. The apartment was locked from the inside. But the people involved in these cults, these satanic cults, they're pros. They break, going through locks, and you know, a lot of them have been trained in the military, to be honest with you. Some of them have. I can't say a lot of them. I don't, you know, cirrhosis of the liver and slight pneumonia of each lung, you have a lingering death. You don't have a sudden death like that. And there was, I know, as I recall, there was no record of her ever having had cirrhosis of the liver. If there was, it wasn't anything that would cause her to die immediately, as she did, obviously, immediately.
Yes.
So, anyway, that's, I kind of gave a real quick overview of the case. Do you have any more questions?
Well, you know, there's a couple of people that seem to have just conveniently disappeared from this thing. I mean, and it's certainly troubling. I mean, it indicates a massive cover-up. Dwight Smith, you know, where is this guy? Is he around? Is he locatable? Alan Mazerol, what was his role in that?
Okay, Dwight Smith. The last I heard, Dwight Smith was living on a boat in San Francisco with another individual. He's the person with the sergeant's, with the Army fatigue jacket with E6 sergeant stripes on it.
Mm-hmm.
He was seen that night earlier before the murders, that night before the murders, which had been the same night as the murders, in downtown with Helena coming out of a nightclub. And as a matter of fact, Prince Beasy was the one that saw him. Saw him and Helena coming out of the nightclub that night. I don't know if Prince had a surveillance on the nightclub or not, but he did see him. He told me that.
Yeah.
And Dwight Smith, last I heard, was he was on a boat and living on a boat in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and he was a contract killer for the cult. And Alan Mazerol denied that he was there that night and claimed that there were records in the county courthouse that showed he was not there, that he was in jail that night. But Prince gave me a signed statement that he was out on bond, out on bail that night, and that he was not in jail that night. And the reason Prince remembers that is because he was supposed to testify at a hearing on that very day, February 17th, I think it was. And that, wasn't that the date of the murders? Yeah.
Yes.
1970. And Prince was to testify that day at his hearing, and they didn't have the hearing because he was out. He wasn't. He was out on bail and never showed up. And this is Alan Mazerol. Now, Alina told me that Alan Mazerol, by the way, the cult distributing the drugs up and down the East Coast for the army that was bringing the drugs in to the base there. And I forget where I was going in just a minute now. But Alina, anyway, Alina told me that Mazerol was heavily involved in distributing the drugs up and down the East Coast. And the last I heard about Mazerol, he was driving a truck of potatoes from Maine into New York City. Well, what a perfect cover to distribute drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Shelby Don Harris, after the murders, he went to Nashville and had a job as a nurse's aide or a hospital aide of some sort. And he learned in, he ended up there. That's the last I heard of him. I haven't heard mm-hmm. anything from him for years. I have not been active in the case myself. I think it was May of 82 was the last time I was actively involved in it. And that was the last session that I had with Helena. It was about a 10-day session. And what happened, the reason I had that was the third session. I had three sessions with her, one, two, and three. This was the third session because after my second session, the FBI interviewed her, and she did not recant her signed statement to me, but they came out publicly and said she did recant her statement, what she did say was that she, I forget exactly what she said about the interview, my interview with her, but that, I know what it was. There was a picture in the Washington Post, and then Alina was identified in the picture as being involved, a suspect in the McDonald murders. And she was a babysitter, and she loved children, by the way, believe it or not. But she was high on drugs. She didn't know what she was doing that night. And she was a babysitter, and the people who were, she was babysitting for saw the picture and read the article in the Washington Post and fired her. And so she was mad at me, and the FBI then came out and interviewed her, tried to get her to recant. She never recanted. She was just upset with me because of that. And then they went public and said that she recanted. She never did recant her statement.
So we have obstruction of justice by the
exactly,
FBI.
Exactly, obstruction of justice. And so... That was, and then she, on the third session, she contacted me, said, Ted, I had a good relationship with her. She said, Ted, get back here. And I met her in South Carolina again, outside of, Clemson University. Isn't there a town named Clemson in South Carolina? Clemson, South Carolina?
Well, there's a school by that name. I think so. Yeah, there is.
Yeah,
I think it is. And
anyway, so she sat down and she gave me another statement that she did not recant it, and that she stands by the original statement that she gave me. And so I said, Helena, would you be interested in appearing on 60 Minutes? I happen to have a contact in 60 Minutes, one of the producers of 60 Minutes. And I called him, and Joe Wirschbaugh was his name, as I recall. Gosh, I haven't thought of these names in years.
I'm a good investigator.
I don't know, but sometimes I think I'm losing my memory. You know, I'm 80 years old now.
Oh, no, you're doing great. I wanted to bring these things out, not to get you off track. Let me make this statement. Ken Adachi, and you asked Ken if this isn't true, asked me off the air where I thought Dwight Smith was, and I immediately told him he's in California. I'm sensing the San Francisco area.
Right.
So you just confirmed something that I told Ken 5 or 6 months ago.
Yeah. Well, he's still in the cult, and he's a contract killer for them. And so I had Joe Wirschbaugh. I called Joe. I knew him through Louis L'Amour, the famous Western writer, who was a friend of mine, and later passed away. Because Joe had done a story on Louis L'Amour on 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I called Joe, and he came. I told him, you know, hey, Joe, come on down. I got an interview here for you. So he came down, hired a local camera crew, and I interviewed Helena on camera for 60 Minutes. And then the CBS and Joe took the film and so on and so forth. That's been shown on a number of shows in the past, like 48 Hours Mysteries and what have you, that interview I did with her. There was another thought I had about, maybe it was about Dwight Smith, I forget right offhand. But anyway, that was, I 60 Minutes never did anything with it. I gave it to them on a silver platter, and nobody's ever, in the national media, has ever really covered the McDonald story honestly, okay? And then, of course, we had Joe, what was the guy that wrote the book Fatal Vision? The author.
I don't recall his name, but I even read the book. So
yeah. Anyway, we had him come out with Fatal Vision, portraying Dr. McDonald as guilty, and then a fellow named Jerry Potter came to me after that and wanted to write a book about me, and I said, you know, Jerry, forget about me. Here's the story right here. Write the story. Write a book about Dr. McDonald. And so he and Fred Boss teamed up, co-authored the book Fatal Justice, which tells the real, true story on what happened. It's full.
Joe McGinnis wrote the book.
Joe McGinnis,
Fatal
that's
Vision.
It. Yeah, right. I knew that kid. As a matter of fact, I appeared on a radio show with Joe. And I did a job on it, to be honest. I was told later by an attorney who listened to the show, the radio show here in Los Angeles, that I didn't do any. He could not have done a better job of quizzing Joe McGinnis down. I was on I forget the name of the show, the very famous talk show host here in Los Angeles. So anyway, that's, you know, gosh, it's been years since I discussed this case with any detail at all. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else. Of course, we all know about the latest on the DNA and all that sort of thing, and as far as the attorneys are concerned, to be honest with you, attorneys, I'm not real popular with attorneys once I enter the case. I was not popular with Bernard Siegel. Dennis Eisman, by the way, was a murderer. They said he committed suicide. He was murdered in a parking garage in Philadelphia later. I don't think Brian O'Neill particularly liked me. In fact, I would call Brian O'Neill and give him suggestions on what to do, and he would just ignore me. So I finally started writing him letters, and he still ignored me, but at least it was on paper. I had a paper trail on it. But
yeah.
Most attorneys do not have imagination. I mean, it's all cut and dried. The law book says this, and this is the way it is. And I'm a guy with a little bit of imagination and some, you know, I'm a free thinker. I think of there's a possibility. I have a good instinct. And so attorneys, I'm not real usually too popular with attorneys when I enter a case. In fact, I just had a case here. I'm working cases here in Los Angeles right now. And I just had a case where I couldn't get along with the attorney, and she would not cooperate with me. And she was unsuccessful with the client, to be honest with you. And so anyway, that's, you know, I don't pay attention to them. I just, if they want to use my services and use my thoughts, it's available. If it isn't, why, except for the possibility that the poor victim is the defendant, you know, I'm concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically, I can't think, can you think of any other questions you want to ask me?
Well, probably the $64,000 question is what, and I know that you're not a prophet, so, but you're darn close to being one. What do you think the outcome of this appeal is going to be? On the exculpatory evidence that's
Well, I think we're going to win. Finally, we're going to win. I think finally we're going to win. I mean, what better evidence do we have than hair with a root on it under the child's fingernail?
Yes.
Okay? And I'm, by the way, to be honest with you, I'm in the process of writing a book right now on the case, on my involvement in the case. And I just finished preparing a proposal for the book, and I'm going to present it to somebody, an agent of some sort, and we'll see what happens. Now, I've also been told there's a professor in Philadelphia who's done a book on me. He's already written the book, presented it to the literary world on the East Coast primarily, because that's where most of them are in New York City, and I've been blackballed in the literary world.
Hmm.
So people just don't want to hear what I have to say. But, you know, personally it doesn't bother me except for the fact that I'm for truth and justice, and if they don't like that, that's just too bad. It's their problem.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to win.
If your book takes off and becomes a movie, please consider me for the music score, if you would.
Well, yeah, by all means. And be sure to call me and remind me, will you?
I'll call you tomorrow. No, I'm just kidding.
I went a long way from getting it published. They may not even publish it because of my name, you know, but I, you know, so be it.
Well, we'll have you on the show to talk about the book, too, and help you promote it as well.
Sure.
You know, we have to get this word out anyway.
Right, right.
Well, there is another issue that I would like to discuss. Recently, and I'm going to preface my question with a remark, I've been watching this birth certificate dialectical argument that's going on, and I don't know if you've read any of my research, but I've uncovered a hornet's nest of information about Barack Obama's background, and I've been following the lawsuits and doing the forensic investigation that a good journalist does. I discovered that Joseph Tates, the husband of Dr. Orley Tates, who filed the suit on behalf of Alan Keyes and some people in the military, has a company called Daylight Chemical Information Systems, Inc., that works hand-in-hand and has for at least 9 years with Novartis, the company that holds the bird swine flu patent.
Right.
And that is a smoking cannon as far as a relationship of running interference and misdirection, which is the method that's been used throughout this dialectical argument. And it's a lot of people around the world, especially those that have been the whistleblowers about these vaccines that they're trying to force down everyone's throat, are being developed. And Orley Tate's husband has been working with that company, and they're using the Oracle 8i technology. This was on the internet. This was actually on a Chinese website that I found this. And they're internationally putting all of this together. And they're using the Promis software. They're using that or a derivative of it to do the calculations that they have to replicate these diseases. They're doing all this by computer. So we know how they're doing it. And I know that going back into the days when this software was basically hijacked by the Justice Department under the auspice of using it for the bankruptcy courts, you happen to know Michael Reconosciuto. You had some contact with him.
I'm in constant contact with him. In fact, I'm going to see him Sunday.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Michael's one of my closest friends. Michael and I have worked together since 1982. And Michael and I are responsible for the conviction of 5 contract killers in the L.A. area.
How long ago was that?
Back in the 80s.
Back in the 80s, okay. We know that he was instrumental in, let's say, adapting that software to, you know, some of the current uses.
Yeah.
I understand from some sources that I've spoken with over the past year or so that there were about 88 different versions of this software out there now, and they've used it to infiltrate banks and governments and just anything you can think of. What state is Michael in these days? I know that.
I know that
he was in prison for a while. I don't. Is he still in prison, or let him out? Or
no, he's still in prison. He served 16 years, and 10 more years he'll be out on based on good behavior. He was originally sentenced to 30 years.
And what was the crime he committed?
Oh, they said that he was involved in manufacturing methamphetamine.
That's the standard charge, isn't it?
Well, you see, Michael, when he had when the Department of Justice had the Promis software in their possession, they leased it from the Hamiltons, Bill and Nancy Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Department of Justice had control of it, Michael put a trap door in it. And then later, after the case was lost, and the lawsuit by the Hamiltons, they lost the lawsuit. They won in court, but the court said you're in bankruptcy court. You belong across the street. So they didn't have another $1 million to put into the case. When they lost the case, then a fellow named Earl Bryant, past owner of United Press International, took that software, Promis software, and peddled it around the world to other countries. I know he sold it to the Canadians, English, French, and the Israelis, and then and other countries also. And when Michael had control, when the Department just had control of it, and Michael worked for the CIA, he will never, you know, the CIA people don't admit that, but obviously he was a CIA scientist, he put a trap door in it. And then when it was sold around the country to other around the world to other countries, these other countries did not know there was a trap door in there. So we were actually retrieving their intelligence information without their knowledge. And the Brooks Committee in late 1980s had a hearing on this. And they called Michael and they said, "We want you to testify." Michael said, "Okay." And then he received a call from, according to Michael, a fellow named Peter Vitniks, who was a Department of Justice official. And Vitniks, according to Michael now, I can't document this or prove it, said that Vitniks told him, "If you testify, you'll be sorry." And then Michael said, "You know, forget it. I'm not going to pay any attention to you." And Michael's, when he worked for the government, thought he was doing the right thing. It was only after he became involved in a number of key issues that he said, "You know, this isn't right." And he turned on him. So he testified anyway, and shortly thereafter, Michael was arrested for methamphetamine laboratory in North Central Washington State. I jumped on a plane as soon as he was arrested, flew up to Seattle, Tacoma actually, and got a rental car, went up there, and looked over the scene, and they said that he had a meth lab, but Michael said that he was developing gold from a new system for gold from iron, from ore. And Michael is a brilliant scientist. He's one of the most intelligent men I've ever known. He has a photographic memory. And Now, according to Michael, they came in and they broke all the laboratory equipment, the glass and so forth that he was using to in his laboratory. And if they had kept the laboratory, the glass, and examined it, they would have found that it had certain chemicals in it that he would use, that he used on the ore, but there was a chemical that was not used, that was, and they could have proven this, that was necessary to use in methamphetamine. So anyway, that's what happened to Michael. And he's, like, he's in prison. I'm going to see him this Sunday. As a matter, I've been in touch with him. I send him money when I have it and help him as best I can. By the way, I might mention also, Don, that going back to the McDonald case, and we have any more questions on the promise, I'll come back to it.
Okay.
In June of 1982, I'm on a Friday. I think it was Friday 13th, but I'm not sure if it's on, if there's a Friday 13th in June of 82. But anyway, it was on a Friday, and I had a friend staying with me, a man. And he opens the door on a Friday morning, and the front door, and here's 13 dead chrysanthemums and 13 dead roses with a note. And it said, "Poacher in the grass, once a cub, the lion sees shades of death and life," and it was signed Eddie. And it was dated June 15, 1982. I still have the note, by the way. So, you know, I'm saying, Now, Dwight Smith was known as Eddie. He was known as Zigzag. And those are some of his aliases. So I don't know if Dwight Smith left that there or not, the black male with the E6 Sergeant Stripe fatigue uniform on in the McDonald case. So, and then later, I had an engagement. I was staying with a friend. I didn't stay at home, the same apartment. It was a apartment. It was a triplex that opened, my door opened right onto the street. And then later, I was visiting a friend, spent the night there. And that night, that particular night, my landlady came home at 1:30 in the morning, and two men were sitting across from my front door in a car. And one of them gets out and walks over to the landlady and asks her, "Do you know where Ted Gunderson lives?" And I'd always told my landlady, if anybody asks about you, don't know me. So then he gets back in the car. She said no. Gets back in the car and drives off. Now, I had a pattern. What they do on, when they're going to hit you, a contract killing, they run surveillances on you, check your pattern. They try to figure out when's the best place to hit you and when's the best time to hit you. And usually I had an office in Westwood Village, and usually I'd come home around 10:30, 11, sometimes midnight. And it was like a clockwork, you know, and so this particular night, I did not go home, and these men were sitting across my front door, asked the landlady about me. So the next day, when the landlady told me about this, I called, I started making phone calls, and I found out I had a contract out on me. And I was able to get that contract taken off by through certain means, by contacting certain people, fortunately. And I've had other contracts. In fact, I found out from contacting this particular person that I had two contracts on me at the same time. And one of them was by the satanic cult. And as a matter of fact, I just had a satanic, subliminal satanic message on my cell phone yesterday. It was clanging and then some music. And you know, they harass me regularly. It's obviously satanic cult / a covert criminal government enterprise that's been infiltrated by the cult. There's no question about that. Our military intelligence and the FBI, in my opinion, based on my research, and the CIA and the NSA have all been infiltrated by satanic cults.
Yeah, and you could probably throw FEMA into that, too, as well.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, I'm sure, yeah.
And we could go on, DEA, DIA.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's a shame, but you know, this truth has to come out. And of course, they hate when the truth comes out. It really angers them.
Well, yeah, that's why they hate me so much. And it's as a matter of fact, if you go on my website, freeviamail.com, and also tedgunderson.net, if you go on my website, I received here several months ago an anonymous phone call at my home, two anonymous phone calls to my home in Nebraska. I was living in Nebraska. So I had to move from Las Vegas to Nebraska in 2005 because I was being poisoned through the air from the condominium next door. I was suspicious of it. I took a test, and I had arsenic cyanide in me, and I said, you know, I got to get out of here. I left within 2 weeks. Fortunately, John DeCamp, my friend in Nebraska, who was an American hero on the Franklin cover-up case, came to my rescue and said, come on back, and I moved in to his house there with 4 bedrooms, 2 baths. He gave it to me for $550 a month rent. And I've had to move around a little bit, and then they don't like me, and I understand why.
Yeah, and they have a habit of sicking their disinformation agents out on you on the internet, putting out all kinds of trash after having stole boxes and boxes of your documents.
Yeah, I had over 200 boxes of my research stolen here in October, November 2008. Yeah.
And the family recipes as well, I understand.
Oh, yeah, Stu Webb took those. that was insult. That's of all the insults, that was it, you know. Take my mother and grandmother's recipes that we had in the family for years. Stu Webb is an FBI informant, and I have documentation. I can say that without any question. And I can, if somebody comes to me, I'll say, yeah, here's the documentation. I have him on a video. He was interviewed, and he made a statement on the video that he was working with Robin Salvador, an FBI agent in Las Vegas, Nevada, and he'd been given a symbol number. And I'm watching this video, and I can't believe it, because symbol numbers are given to our FBI confidential informants so that when they give information and put it in a report, they cannot be identified. So they give them a symbol number, the FBI does. And the average person doesn't know what that means for him to be given a symbol number. Well, you're given a symbol number if you're an informant. So I have this on a video, and I put it up. It was sent to me. It was produced by I can't think of Jack's name right off hand in Dallas, Texas. So I put this video on the shelf, and about 10 days later I was talking. And, of course, on the telephone, I saw it on the TV screen, and I almost fell off the couch. I couldn't believe that he made that admission. And so I called somebody about 10. Are you there, John?
Yeah, I'm here. You sound like your phone moved away from your mouth.
No, yeah, that's what I think the boys are playing with it. Can you hear me now?
Your volume went way, way down.
Yeah, well, the boys are playing.
Now you're back.
NSA are playing games.
Oh, okay.
So what I did is I took the video. First of all, I was talking to a friend in North Carolina. I said, I've got this video where this Stu Webb admits he's an FBI informant in so many words because he said he was given a symbol number. And so he said, send me a copy. So I took it off the shelf. This was like 10 days later. I made a copy and I sent it to him. And he says, it's not on there. So I got the master down off the shelf myself again and watched it. And in the original, it was 23 minutes into the video, he came on and made this statement. And the one that I had on the shelf that I made a copy from 10 days later, it was not there. So it was taken out. So somebody came into my house and took that out. Now, how did they know that I had that information 23 minutes into the video? The only way they would know is because they were watching through the TV set. They monitor the people, Americans, through the TV set. And because that was the only place where I said it other than on the telephone. And that was 10 days later. So I called the producer and got another copy, and I have both. I have one without it and one with it.
Yeah, now they do it with high definition.
Right.
As our Congress is concerned about the quality of our television viewing, infomercials and what have you.
Yeah, Congress has been infiltrated by the Illuminati.
Yes. Well, we know that, and we talk about it because we're not afraid.
That's right.
The truth comes out. They're afraid of the truth.
They don't want
there's
the truth.
No doubt about it.
Absolutely.
There's no. Well, Ted, I don't want to keep you up all night. We appreciate you coming on the air on such short notice and revealing all this fantastic information to the listener.
I'm glad to do it anytime.
And but don't be such a stranger.
Let me mention one other thing. In the last 30 years, I've written like over 40 reports, and I put all these reports on one CD, and it's 6,500 pages. Oklahoma City, which I personally investigated, 911, I personally was involved in developing information on that, and other, and the Finders, which is a CIA child kidnapping ring, as well documented in my report. And I put it on a CD, and that CD is available to anybody listening to this show. And send me $35, and I'll send this CD to you. And you have to watch it on your computer. You can read my reports on your computer. Send your $35 to Ted Gunderson, 123 North 3rd Street, Beatrice, Nebraska, 68310. I'll repeat that. Ted Gunderson, 123 North 3rd Street, Beatrice, Nebraska, 68310. So send that to me, and also check my website at freeviamail.com and tedgunderson.net. I have over 400, between 400 and 500 DVDs that are available to the public and through my my website. I have a dynamic library of information.
Yes, and we're not hearing the truth from the mainstream media. You know, you're talking about one-third the price most people are paying to have cable television and internet in their home. That's certainly worth saving people a lot of time looking for these things. And many of them they're not going to find. This is all original research that you've done.
That's right. Oh, yeah. This is my work.
Well, our hats off to you, Ted. I really appreciate you coming on, as I just said a moment ago. And I intended to get you on my schedule next month anyway. So plan on being on Evident Footprints in September, if you would kindly do so.
Give me a call.
Okay. All right, Ted, you be
and
safe.
Let's tell Ken. Ken, if you're listening, get well soon. We all love you. You're the fantastic. You talk about an American hero. Ken is an American hero.
Oh, I know, and he's a good friend.
He's a great guy, and he's a good friend of mine. He's supported me like you can't believe.
Yes. Yes. Ted, you be safe. Godspeed, and our prayers are with you.
Thank you, my friend. Same back to you.
Okay, you have a good night. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and our special guest tonight, Mr. Ted Gunderson. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, including those listening in on blogtalkradio.com and Wind Talkers Radio Network. I wish everyone in the listening audience a night or day filled with peace, love, and light, and for those of you in the dark sections of the world, have a good night.